The Life of Dwight L. Moody, Chapter 26, Second Extended Mission in Great Britain. The memory of Mr. Moody's work in Great Britain was a great inducement to him to accept a most urgent invitation to return for a similar mission in the fall of 1881. In many respects, the work of this visit was like that of the first. Many of its experiences were repeated in the cities visited on this occasion. It almost seemed that he took up the work just where he had left it 6 years before. From the first, he met the heartiest support from ministers of all denominations, and the same general interest was evinced everywhere. As on the previous occasion, the mission began in the north of England, this time in Newcastle-on-Tyne, where Mr. Moody conducted meetings during the latter part of October and the first 2 weeks of November. Edinburgh was then visited, and a six-week mission was held, and this was followed by 5 months' work in Glasgow and the immediate vicinity. In this city, Professor Henry Drummond again assisted Mr. Moody in his work, and the friendship began during the earlier visit became more deeply rooted. Saturday, which Mr. Moody observed as his day of rest, was usually spent with his family, and Drummond was often a welcome addition to the small circle. Mr. Moody would turn continually to him in those days for advice and fellowship, and their attachment deepened into the warmest love. In Edinburgh and Glasgow, Mr. Moody introduced a new feature into his work by conducting Saturday morning meetings for children. On these occasions, he would give illustrated sermons to the little ones, presenting the gospel truth through sight as well as hearing. Although it was a novel and pretty sight, says a writer in describing one of these services, the mingling of white-headed and venerable fathers with bright little children, some of them not more than 5 years old. For example, Mr. Sankey was quite surrounded with little people. Dr. Carnes, too, was besieged, and it would be hard to decide whether the esteemed principal or his youthful neighbors appeared the happier. William Dickinson and several other gentlemen acted the part of attentive and kindly monitors. Mr. Moody began his address to the children by reading from the Sermon on the Mount 3 verses, beginning, "Ye are the light of the world." After speaking about the light of the world, he showed the children may be lights, and by a series of questions brought out the idea that children should be obedient. Accepting this answer, he told the story of Adam's fall because of his disobedience. Suddenly he called upon Mr. Dickinson to produce a candle, to place it on the table, and to clear the table of everything else, so that everybody might see the light. The burning candle was placed in the center of the table. "Now," he added, "we will call that obedience. Remember that." Mr. Dickinson put obedience under a bushel. Immediately Mr. Dickens covered the candle with a bushel. "Is that right?" asked Mr. Moody. "No, for neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light to all that are in the house." He ordered a bushel raised again, and obedience was once more seen, giving light to all that were in the house. This time, placed not under, but on top of the bushel. Adam, Mr. Moody proceeded to remark, when he sinned, hid himself, and was thus like the candle under a bushel. As he proceeded, he had another candle lighted, giving to each a name, and now and again asking all the children to repeat them, occasionally telling anecdotes applicable to the matter in hand, and asking for illustrative texts. The list of lights, when completed, was as follows: obedience, kindness, forgiveness, truth, peacemaking, temperance, faith, mercy, patience, cheerfulness, love. The meeting passed all too quickly for the little people, who thought that Mr. Moody was one of the best ministers they'd ever heard. Dr. Andrew A. Bernard, who had worked with Mr. Moody in the first campaign in 1874 and had also been with him in Norfield in 1881, made this entry in his diary on June 9, 1882. "This week, Mr. Moody closes his 5 months' work among us. And now looking back, I think it was the Lord who inclined me to go last season to America, and thus helped to engage him to come to us. I thank the Lord for my being used in some way to help him in the knowledge of the Word and truth. It seems to me plain that the Lord shows His sovereignty by making that man a vessel through which the converting power of God may be poured out on various classes of men. The drunkards have had their day of visitation, and many others of working men especially. I can now see in the great blessing before us an answer to my prayers on board the ship in my journey to and from America. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 3, has been fulfilled in me. He has shown me great things, which I knew not. One marked effect upon ministers here has been the state of expectation in which they now are. They are looking for real results. Closing his work in Glasgow in June, having held meetings here for 5 months, Mr. Moody made short visits to some of the large centers of Scotland, holding conventions and organizing evangelistic work. During the winter, a large number of invitations had been continually coming to Mr. Moody to visit different English cities, as well as Ireland and Wales. In order to perfect arrangements for the coming year, a committee of 70 gentlemen representing the different cities that visited Mr. Moody to visit them, different cities that wished Mr. Moody to visit them, met him in London. In this conference, plans were made for visiting the leading cities of the south of England and Wales. Mr. Moody made a characteristic address saying that he could not visit in a lifetime all the places from which invitations had come. He did not intend to spend the remainder of his days in England, for he felt that his work lay more in America. He thought that if he devoted some months to the principal towns of Scotland, then gave a year to England, with a visit to Paris and Ireland, that a year in London would finish his mission in that country. The latter was referred to a London committee, and the program outlined by Mr. Moody was practically carried out. Mr. Stebbins, who accompanied Mr. Moody on his mission at this time, writes as follows: "We had the pleasure of accompanying Mr. Moody and Professor Drummond on a short visit to many of the larger towns and cities throughout Scotland. This tour Mr. Moody enjoyed to the full. The change from a crowded and smoky city to the fresh and invigorating air of the Scottish hills, covered with heather and dotted over with grazing herds of sheep and cattle, was a constant source of delight to him. In this campaign, he took in many of the small towns as well as the large cities. Often they were near together, so we four would drive from place to place instead of going by rail. Mr. Moody was always troubled because the parks or landed estates, with their beautiful castles and gardens, were surrounded by high stone walls that shut in all the beauty. How he enjoyed these drives! He noticed every babbling brook, and not a lark soared in heaven nor a hedgerow escaped his attention. Flowers were always a source of pleasure to him, and often he would stop the carriage, and Professor Drummond would jump out to pick them, and then tell us the names and point out to us new beauties of shape or color. After a fortnight rest with his family in Switzerland, Mr. Moody began the winter's mission by visiting Swansea, Cardiff, Newport, Plymouth, and Devonport during September and the first week of October. Then a fortnight in Paris, a week in Bristol, a week each at Cambridge and Oxford, and meetings lasted from 3 days to a week in Torquay, Exeter, Southampton, Portsmouth, and Brighton during October, November, and December. The month of January 1883 he spent in Ireland. The month of February was divided between Birmingham, Leicester, and Nottingham. The 2 weeks meetings were held each in Manchester, Leeds, and Liverpool. In this work in Great Britain, there was the same program as on the previous visit, the evangelistic campaign ending in a London mission. On the conclusion of the meetings in Liverpool in the latter part of April, Mr. Moody returned to America. At this time, the Northfield Seminary and Mount Hermon School were in their infancy and needed his presence for several months' supervision and personal care. In the fall, however, he returned to Britain, remaining in Ireland for a month's work before beginning that memorable 8 months' mission in London. Great as has been the success of the meetings in London in April of 1875, Moody's second visit in 1883 was marked by still greater preparations. A large committee was formed in the early spring, composed of many of the leading Christian men in London. Hugh M. Matheson, to whom Mr. Moody had committed the hymn book royalty in 1875, was elected chairman. The committee took charge of the erection of large buildings of congregate iron and wood in London. This work, devoted chiefly upon Robert Padden and Mr. Matheson, who had to select the sites, arrange with architects the buildings, and generally manage the whole business. Concerning this campaign in which he took such an active part, Mr. Matheson said, "We were discussing with Moody at a large meeting the method to be followed in London, using the plan which I prepared on the spur of the moment while occupying the chair, and which defined the order to be followed in the missions in the various districts north and south of the Thames, and the dates of each. To the amazement of the committee, this was accepted absolutely by Mr. Moody, and the program was followed to the minutest detail all through the London campaign, with a success that was quite remarkable. Two halls were built, one in Islington, in the grounds of the Priory, and the other at Wandsworth. While the Islington meeting were finished, and we went to Wandsworth, the Islington Hall was taken down and erected at St. Pancras, and while St. Pancras was being occupied, the Wandsworth Hall was removed to Clapham, and so on, north and south being occupied alternatively for 3 weeks in each place, until practically the entire city had enjoyed the opportunity of being present at the services. It was a wonderful time and made a very deep impression. The whole mission cost over £20,000, and this sum was raised by special contributions. The royalty on hymn books was arranged very much as on the former occasion, save that this time Monsignor Quentin Hogg and Robert Padden was associated with me and shared the responsibilities. We arranged in detail with Monsignor Morgan and Scott the royalties to be paid upon each edition of the book, and at the end I was able to remit to America to the trustees for the Northfield schools, which Mr. Moody was desirous of founding, and which have since attracted so much attention, no less a sum than £10,000, about $50,000. On November 4th, 1883, the long campaign in London was begun. Hall number 1 was called Priory Hall and was erected in Upper Street, Islington. The hall had a seating capacity of 5,000, and the inside appearance was pleasing to the eye, while in the matter of acoustics, it was as nearly perfect as possible. At the opening meeting, Mr. Moody said, "I have come to London with high hopes and great expectations. I have about 100 times more faith than I had when I came here 8 years ago. Some people have said that the former work in London hasn't lasted. I want to say that since then, I have been preaching all through America, from Maine to the Pacific Slope, and that wherever I have gone, I have found that the fruit of that London work, it is scattered all over the earth." At this time, the Bishop of Rochester addressed a letter to the Vicar of St. John's, Blackheath, expressing his desire that the Vicar should give consent and sympathy to our kinsman, the American evangelist, who proposed to help us with our overwhelming work in South London this winter. He said that these men were personally known to him. "More than once I have come across their track in their own country, and I have heard nothing but good of them. To call them schismatics is to trifle with the language. To suspect them of secular movements is to do them a great injustice. Their religious services are simple, reverent, and deeply impressive. Their recent labors, not only in our towns, but also in our two great English universities, are standing the hardest test, that of time. Should anyone doubt if their doctrine is pure or their work solid, let him do what I myself have done and hope to do again, hear and judge for himself. My own desire is that God will raise up 10,000 such men to proclaim His redeeming love. In referring to the meeting the first week, the Pall Mall Gazette said, "Cultured society will blush to know anything about Monsignor Moody and Sankey and others of the crowd. Revivalist in religion, and American revivalist in particular, is desperately vulgar. But, unfortunately, the same might be said with equal truth of every popular movement, religious and irreligious, of all kinds. Almost every religion has its origin among men of low degree, and the sons of fishermen and carpenters who create or revive the faiths and superstitions of mankind are, as a rule, very objectionable persons to the estimation of the men of light and leading of their time. It is only when the first fever of the new faith begins to cool and its vitality to disappear that polite society condescends to investigate its origin and study the phenomenon, sociological or otherwise, which it presents. The enchantment of distance renders it possible for self-respecting sons of culture to study, after the lapse of a century, religious revivals which, to the contemporaries, were too vulgar to be noticed except with a passing sneer." It is somewhat irrational, however, to subject the scars and lava of extinct volcanoes to the most minute analysis, while craters in full eruption are treated as non-existence. Nor can a plain man see the sense of poring over dreary tombs describing the enthusiasm of some preaching friars of the Middle Ages, often as dirty and bigoted as they were vulgar, while the labors of such later-day friars as the American revivalists, who have now pitched their tent, in this case a portable iron building capable of holding 5,000 persons in the north of London, are disregarded. Moody and Sankey are not, it is true, graduates of any university. They are men of the people, speaking the language and using the methods, not of the refined, but of the generality. Yet they have probably left a deeper impress of their individuality upon one great section of Englishmen and Englishwomen than any other persons could be named. Wherever we may think of them, however much their methods may grade upon the susceptibilities of those who have at length succeeded in living up to their blue china, these men are factors of considerable potency in the complex sum of influences which make up contemporary English life. As such, they merit more attention than they have hitherto received from the organs of public opinion. And for that reason, a full account of the American revivalists and their services last night, which we published in another part of the paper, may be studied with interest by some of our readers, and passed over. Let us hope without too great a shock to their feelings by the rest. In the first London campaign in 1875, great crowds gathered at a few large halls, but in the second series of meetings, the halls were taken to the crowded districts, the object being to get nearer to the people who could not or would not go to the larger and more central halls, and that object was admirably secured. In the Nazareth synagogue, the Savior quoted the prophecy from Isaiah that the poor have the gospel preached unto them. While no class was excluded during these series of meetings, the poor especially were reached. The Reverend James Guinness Rogers wrote to the London Congregationalist at the time, "Mr. Moody, conduct of the entire meeting was remarkable manifestation of the way in which the fibre of his zeal is helped by his extraordinary sagacity and by the tact of a shrewd man. Sanctified common sense and characteristic of the man everywhere, and quite as much in his management of the proceedings as in his own address. He understands how much depends on detail, and great care is given to the veriest trifle. He remembers, too, what many of those who claim to be scientific forget, that men have bodies as well as souls, and that these two act and react upon each other. And he does his utmost to guard against the discomfort and weariness which may so easily mar the effect of the best sermon." We His one aim is to get that into the heart of the people. And if he sees anything which seems to hinder him in this, he spares no effort to get it out of the way. During the mission, that winter meetings were held in all parts of London. As may be judged by the fact that the temporary buildings were erected on 11 different sites, from Hampstead Heath on the north through Croydon on the south, and from Stepney on the east to Kensington on the west. During these months, Mr. Moody spoke to crowded halls at least twice a day, and on several occasions, four or even five times. It was estimated that during the London mission, he spoke to over 2 million people. At many of the meetings, entrance was by ticket only, of which over 4,000 were issued during the 8 months. On May 27th, a three-week mission was begun on the Thames embankment in the hall situated on the vacant ground near Temple Gardens. The opening service at Temple Gardens Hall was the beginning of the end. Since the work had included the outlying portion of the metropolis during the previous 7 months, it was fitting that the great campaign should terminate in the very heart of the city. The attendance was very large, embracing all grades and sections of the community, from peers of the realm to the poorest of the poor. Mr. Sankey was obliged to return to America before the London meetings closed, as his health necessitated his taking a rest. The additional burden thrown upon Mr. Moody by his colleague's absence only served to bring out into stronger relief his wonderful powers of adjustment and endurance. From early morning until late at night, and practically all day on Sunday, he was busy speaking, active in inquiry meetings, in conference with committees concerning the work, and conferring individually with those who needed personal help. The closing of this mission by a conference for Christians was in line with other campaigns, and June 17th through the 19th was set as the date for this feature of the work. In the afternoon, the Lord's Supper was observed after an address on the Holy Spirit by Mr. Moody. In his invitation to the congregation to remain to the memorial feast, he emphasized the fact that only those who had received Christ and were in communion with the Lord could rightly observe the ordinance, so that all who should remain would do so as a confession of faith in Christ. The sight of thousands who gathered around the sacred emblems was deeply touching when one remembered the divergence of thought on minor matters that was represented here. At the close of the mission, Mr. Moody accepted an invitation to spend a few days for rest and recreation at the country house of A.T.A. Denny, and later at the home of his brother, Edward Denny. With him were also invited a score or more of those who had assisted in the work in London, including, among others, Professor Drummond, who had returned from this tour into the interior of Africa in time to be present during the closing weeks of the meetings. Those were very delightful days for Mr. Moody, who, free from care and strain of his great work, gave himself up to the relief of social life, enjoying particularly the young men's games. On one occasion, during this period of rest, Mr. Moody succeeded in making a rich discovery for the Christian world by his persistent attempts to draw from Drummond a little of the wealth of information that he possessed. It was on a beautiful Sunday afternoon in June when they were together at the home of Mr. Edward Denny, not far from Tunbridge Wells, whence 13 years later, after months of painful suffering, Drummond entered upon his reward. In those days, however, he was at the zenith of physical strength, and at all standing with the world as the suddenly famous author of Natural Law in the Spiritual World, one of the most modest and unassuming of God's noblemen. An urgent request was made of Mr. Moody to give an informal address. "No," was the response. "You've been hearing me for 8 months, and I am quite exhausted. Here's Drummond. He will give us a Bible reading." With characteristic reluctancy, Drummond consented, and taking from his pocket a little testament, he read the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and then, without a note, and in the most informal way, gave it the beautiful exposition, which has since become so widely known to thousands under the title of The Greatest Thing in the World. 3 years later, when visiting Northfield at Mr. Moody's special request, The same exposition was repeated, both at the students' conference and the August conference, and in response to Mr. Moody's urgent plea, it was later published in its present booklet form. Mr. Moody often said that he wished this address to be read in the Northfield schools every year, and that it would be a good thing to have it read once a month in every church till it be known by heart. Professor Drummond was only 22 when in 1873 he began his work with Mr. Moody in Scotland. When, in later years, the fires of criticism were kindled against Drummond, his great-hearted friends stood by him. He believed in the man with all his heart, even though he might not follow him in all his theories. He knew him to be a Christian who lived continually in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. It is a wonder that the affection between these broad-minded, loving-hearted men became a bond that could not be severed. To those who knew both it was not a matter of surprise that speaking to Dr. Harry Clay Tribble alone at different times in the same day, each should say of his friend, "He is the sweetest-tempered Christian I ever knew."